Welcome to the Pro Politics Podcast. I'm Zach McCreary. I've been working in politics for the better part of two decades, but at heart, I'm a political junkie who wants to talk to interesting people involved in politics. Today, my guest is Jessica Taylor, who you know as the Senate race specialist and editor for the Cook Political Report, now the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter, a development we'll discuss. And I primarily wanted to talk to Jessica as she is a senior author of the recently released Almanac of American Politics 2022. And the political almanacs, which go back 50 years, have been critical in my own path as a political junkie and political professional. So I really enjoyed getting to go deep with Jessica about the history and evolution of the almanacs, and also to talk a bit about her day job at the Cook Report and how she's thinking about the 2022 cycle. Jessica Taylor, tell me how you grew up.
So I grew up in a really small town in Tennessee, Northeast Tennessee, so sort of where Tennessee, Virginia, and North Carolina all meet. It's called Elizabethton. We're part of the Tri-Cities area in Northeast Tennessee. It felt like Friday Night Lights a little bit. Football was the big thing that happened in town, place where everyone kind of knew everybody. My parents had grown up in this town too. They were high school sweethearts. Growing up there, it felt really small, and my goal was to kind of get out, I think. But, you know, looking back, it was a good way to grow up. My dad was the local funeral director, so he knew everyone in town. We couldn't go anywhere without him being stopped and someone talking to him about how much they helped his family. And every morning we'd have breakfast together before I went to school. And my dad had to read the obituaries page to make sure that everything was correct or see who else died and went to different funeral homes. And so he'd kind of read the obituary page and he'd just pass off the rest of the newspaper to me. So I started reading the newspaper and just kind of got very into news and was always sort of fascinated by it and placed in like a sort of a gifted and talented class. And we were supposed to do some sort of project. And I came up with doing a newspaper. It was called the Pirate Press. We Xeroxed it on 8.5 by 11 sheet of green paper. And I think its most salacious feature was the gossip column of who kissed who on the playground. So when I graduated high school, they had everyone go back to your elementary school, and it was actually still being published. It was actually, you know, on actual newsprint now. So, you know, that was my first little foray into journalism. Probably my mom that actually got sort of more involved in local politics. She was PTA president. There was a push that my mom was on to raise the property tax by 1 cent to fund building a new junior high school. You know, we went door to door and it was like, you know, don't you want this little kid to have like a nice place to go to school? That measure unfortunately failed. We're again from a very, very conservative area where anytime you mentioned a tax increase, it's probably not going to work. You know, she was so involved in things like that. She just poured her heart and soul into it. And people that follow me on Twitter probably know that my mom right now, unfortunately, is sort of in the severe stages of Alzheimer's. So that's been really hard. But when I think back to, you know, all of the things that she did, that she was just so involved, it's good memories to think back about. I would say probably the way that I got more interested in national politics in second grade was the 1992 election. And we had neighbors that had just moved in next door to us from Arkansas to open up the Walmart in town. Coming from Arkansas and Walmart headquarters, they knew the Clintons. They were delegates to the DNC. And, you know, she brought me back buttons and like a signed picture of Bill and Hillary. You know, I will stress this should not be indicative of any current political things I hold or do not hold, because I very much try to adhere to a nonpartisan with the Cook Political Report and in my past things. But, you know, I'm 7. I think it's pretty cool that the neighbor has brought me signed things by someone who's running for president. You know, I think I went around our, you know, little Southern Baptist church saying that we were going to vote for Bill Clinton. And my dad was like, we are not voting for Bill Clinton. My parents were very staunch Republicans. So I think that kind of got me interested in that a little bit. And I also remember that year I successfully lobbied my second grade teacher to let us eat lunch in our classroom so that we could watch the inauguration.
Your kid growing up in East Tennessee, you're not in a particularly political family, but you have an interest in the news and journalism and in politics. So how do you go from that kid with those interests to starting to be a working journalist in D.C. covering the news, covering politics?
So my dad he knew the people at the local newspaper really well because he sent in obituaries every day. This is called the Elizabethan Star. It was a daily paper, and they let me come on as an intern when I was 15. So I started writing feature news stories. I profiled, local business owners. I went and interviewed someone in the nursing home. So I did that for 2 summers, actually, before my junior year and before my senior year, along with I worked at the local coffee shop too. So I sort of balanced both of those jobs. My parents really taught me to work hard. So that was sort of my first experience in a newsroom, and it was just a lot of fun. Again, it's a local paper, but I sort of got to see how a newspaper worked. And, you know, when I started looking at colleges, I sort of thought about journalism. I always liked to write, and I think I was someone who asked a lot of questions. And it was actually my 8th grade English teacher, her name was Vivian Johnson, brought up journalism for the first time. You know, you're good at writing, probing mind, you should think about this. So she's the one who kind of got me thinking about that a lot. We didn't have a newspaper at my high school, but I was editor of the yearbook. I was really fortunate to have, I went to public schools my whole life. You know, we didn't have as many, we had honors classes. There was only one AP class. So I know when I went to college, I was sort of behind. I felt behind a lot of people, but we had really good English teachers that really stressed the importance of writing. And you were having to write a 5-paragraph essay once or twice a week. So I remember when I went to college and got in my freshman English class, it was like, you will write 5 papers this term. And other people were like, oh my gosh. And I'm like, that's it. So I really think it was that writing. I started looking at schools for journalism. I visited UNC, for instance, University of Tennessee, of course. I'm a big Tennessee Vol fan, as Zach knows, our big rivalry with Alabama. I think because my high school was so small and I had really good relationships with all of my teachers, I just never really wanted to go to a big school. That just didn't feel like the college experience that I wanted. So, I started looking at smaller liberal arts colleges, and I actually found Furman University, where I ended up going, because I went there for 2 summers for their band camp, for their orchestra camp, and just really fell in love with it. You know, it was close by enough, about 2 hours away in South Carolina. You could feel that it just had good energy and, close relationships you can make with professors and different things. And I almost didn't go, though, because they didn't have a journalism program. And I'm really glad that I didn't stick to that. And this is something I tell students all the time, if they're wanting to go into journalism, is you don't have to have a journalism degree. Going to a liberal arts school and being able to take a lot of different classes. I actually didn't go in intending to be a political science major. I think, I went there on a music scholarship initially. I was going to do music and English and thought about journalism in a way. It was my freshman English class, probably, that our text was the New York Times. We would read the New York Times every day. We'd have to write opinion pieces or analysis of things in the news. My professor there, who was notoriously always one of the hardest professors, I think, she very rarely gave A's and was a really hard grader. Her name was Judy Bainbridge. She was about a 4'10" woman with white hair. And if you wanted to meet with her, you had to sit outside on the bench while she chain smoked. She was legendary, though. She was very hard, but, really kind of encouraged me. She had people she was sort of take under her wing. She was the one sort of, you should take a political science class, and the political science department there at Furman was just really strong. And, I hadn't even really thought about it that much, but I was like, I like politics, I like current events and stuff, and kind of brought me back to that. And I took a few classes and just absolutely fell in love with the department and all of the professors. Also had a professor in there, John Armstrong. I was very set on, I wanted to be a print journalist then. I wanted to write. And he was like, you need to learn all of these things because journalism is changing. And he was like pulling teeth for him to make me take his broadcast journalism class. And I'm really glad I did, because as a journalist, you really have to be able to work in so many different modalities and forms. It's not just you can be this type of journalist. It was the internet, it's radio, it's video. You've got to be able to do it all. But my favorite teacher there, who I still keep in touch with almost weekly, she was my advisor. Like I said, I came in as a music major, but I ended up quitting that after the first year so that I could edit the newspaper there. You go to school in South Carolina and you see a lot of candidates passing by when you go to school in an early primary state. And so Furman was co-hosting with NBC one of the 2004 presidential debates during my freshman year. There were candidates everywhere. So for the newspaper, I was just a staff writer at that point. I got to go cover a John Edwards event, and I was interviewing Howard Dean downtown. And, I'm an 18-year-old kid from rural Tennessee, and this is really cool. I'm talking with people that are running for president. I never thought this would happen. So that's probably when I caught the bug, really, for like political journalism. and you know, people that are there, actually the guy who was editor before me, Caleb McMicken, he's actually the communications director for the Georgia Speaker of the House now. I've run into a lot of alums when I'm covering things up here. Certainly, you know, another Furman alum is a chief of staff for an Iowa congresswoman. So, you know, we're sort of everywhere too, even though we're a small but mighty college. You know, I took over the paper as editor my sophomore year and junior year, and that was probably poured my heart into that. My roommates, I remember we had like our answering machine message, and one of them was, you know, a biology thing. So it was like, Elizabeth's in the lab, Kate's in the music department, and Jessica's probably at the Paladin office, which is where I was. We had a lot of controversy, though, when I was there, too. And I think this sort of taught me to not be afraid to sort of take on people and ask questions. So Furman was on a trimester system when I went there. I liked it. A lot of people liked it. The faculty really wanted to change it. They very much did not seek student input, didn't really hold forums or ask students what they thought. And overwhelmingly, when we were talking with students, they liked it, you know, and didn't want it to change. And they ended up actually taking a secret vote to pass it months before they said they did. We wrote a pretty scathing editorial against it. There was like protests and things too after the curriculum change, and there were people like holding up our newspaper with the sign and everything. So it felt good. Those sort of incidents really taught me a lot.
So what is your step then to actually become a working journalist?
Furman was very good about emphasizing internships, that you needed to get internships. And we had a program called the Furman Advantage. For me, it essentially paid for housing and travel. So this was after my sophomore year. So this was the summer of 2005. I was placed actually at National Journal. This was, you know, right after the 2004 election, obviously. A lot of what I did that summer, anticipating Chief Justice Rehnquist to retire. I was profiling a lot of potential successors, nominees. This was a time when news organizations were trying to figure out what their online profile should look like. So nationaljournal.com is where I worked, which was like separate from the magazine. It was also separate from Hotline, but we were all in the same building. So, you know, it was also thrilling to me as, you know, a 20-year-old to get to work in the historic Watergate building. I'd never even been up to DC before. So this was the first time I'd spent any time in DC, and I was just amazed by everything. And, you know, I caught the Potomac fever and just learned from a lot of the reporters there that were just really great. One of the reporters that I worked with, Meg Kennard, who's, you know, now the star political reporter for the AP in South Carolina, kept a lot of contacts and friendships through that. You know, after I graduated, so I graduated in 2007, I still had at the back of my mind that because I didn't have a journalism degree, I couldn't go be a journalist right out of college. I decided I was going to go to Northwestern and do their journalism program. And they had a political journalism track. It was like a year-long program. I would spend 6 months in Chicago, 6 months in DC. That summer, though, they then told us sometime into July that they were completely changing the journalism program at Northwestern into a journalism and marketing degree that was going to take much longer. So I was going to be in even more debt. And I really didn't want a marketing degree. That wasn't what I wanted to do. And so I made the decision then not to go. Again, my parents thought I was crazy. I was like, I'm going to stick up here and I'm going to get a job. And it was because of connections I had then at National Journal, I started reaching out to people. They had a position that was going to come open in September, but I was free in August. This is sort of how I got involved with the Almanac. I had a friend who I'd met through interning, who had been one of the researchers on the 2006 book. She had been hired to be an embed for NBC and National Journal in the 2008 election. So she was leaving early. They were behind. They really needed someone to come in and fill in just for, you know, a month that could kind of jump in there and knew this stuff. I really didn't even know that much about the Almanac until I got to college and I started using it and reading it. You know, I was fascinated sort of Congress and covering things like that was sort of what I wanted to go into. So, Charlie Mattesian, who was the editor at that time, hired me for sort of, I think it was 4 to 6 weeks or something, a very short contract before sort of the job came open down at National Journal. So, you know, I look back to that, those connections I made at those internships and things really sort of paid off and helped me get my first job.
You currently work at the Kirk Report, and I want to, you know, talk about that and some of the developments happening there. But over the years, you've worked closely with both Charlie Cook and Stu Rothenberg, and many of us think of them as a duo, even though they are competitors. To some degree, you know, they often appeared on television together. What are the differences that you've seen in Stu Rothenberg and Charlie Cook in terms of how they approach elections analysis?
I think it's a great example that you're technically competitors, but they're just so friendly and their families are friendly. I know they and their wives have dinner together all of the time. And they are both just such quality people. Like, they are just nice, kind individuals that really care about the people that work for them. I think Sue can kind of take more of a brusque persona sometimes. and Charlie can be a little bit more laid back, but they both just have such a encyclopedic knowledge of things and bring, you know, Stu came from more of an academic background, certainly, versus, you know, Charlie sort of worked in politics. And so I think that kind of can approach it a little differently in that way in their backgrounds. But, you know, I learned so much from them just about how to interview candidates, how to look at data, how to look at polling. You know, the way that we interviewed candidates is actually sort of the same way you start off the podcast here, is asking people how they grew up. And I think you learn a lot about a person and about a candidate and what type of candidate they could be when you know more about them and what their background is. So that was a really key thing that I looked at. But, you know, again, they're both just absolutely wonderful people.
Thinking about those candidate interviews, is there one that comes to mind that was more colorful or surprising or memorable?
Probably one that sticks out to me most was when we interviewed Ted Cruz in 2012. So this was me, Stu, and Nathan Gonzalez. You know, this was when he was certainly, you know, not seen as the favorite in that primary. It was David Dewhurst that was sort of seen as the establishment type candidate. He came in just very confident in himself. He also didn't bring any staff with him, which is rare. You know, he just came in by himself, sort of had the sort of swagger type about him. And I remember Stu left and he was like, that man looks in the mirror and thinks he's going to be president one day. Like, he was that confident. And I think we sort of saw it as a little bit of an overconfidence. But when you look at the way Cruz has comported himself since, and sort of thorn in the side of Republicans in many ways, and you think back to his, you know, filibuster and different things. So looking back to the way that he came across in that interview, it's very not surprising of the path that he has taken in DC and how people both in and outside the party view him.
And as an editor at the Cook Report, you're the Senate guru, but as you and I are talking, just last week, there was a big announcement in the world of the Cook Political Report. Many of the listeners of a podcast like this no doubt have heard about it, but can you talk about that announcement and what's brewing at the Cook Political Report?
Yeah, so it's a really exciting time. We have sort of changed ownership in a way. It's now, our official name now is the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter. So Amy has been with Charlie for decades, and I would like to stress Charlie is not retiring. He's stepping back, sort of in a way. He's still going to write his columns. He's still going to speak. He and his wife, Lucy, have decamped to Maine, where they have a beautiful house there. I do not envy them, sort of. So, you know, they're going to take some more time for themselves, but Charlie's still very much involved. And, you know, he's still going to contribute and he's still going to write his columns. And those will appear on our site as well as on National Journal. But I think with Amy, it is sort of the next generation of things, you know, and, you know, we're excited to sort of expand and use some, you know, the 21st century tools that we have. And it's still the core team. Myself, David Wasserman, of course, who everyone knows. Allie Flynn is our director. She's now our director of audience engagement. And Allie sort of keeps all the trains running on time, does all of our graphics and online and research and different things. So, you know, we're a small team. We're all really excited. And Amy is just, much like Stu and Charlie, she is just one of the kindest, most positive people. And, you know, she's someone that I have looked to as a mentor since early in my career, because I got to know her when I started there at National Journal. She was editor of Hotline at the time. When I worked in specifically political journalism, there certainly are more women. There's not a lot of women in management and editorial positions, unfortunately. But when you move into more of the world of sort of political analysis and political handicapping, you know, Jennifer that preceded me, Jennifer Duffy and Amy, and then myself, we're sort of the only women out there right now. It's a very male dominated field. There have also been times, unfortunately, some, whether on purpose or not, more than likely not, I think it's just some biases that people have that, you know, there was one instance where we'd all written an analysis on different things and they included Charlie and David's name and they left off mine and Amy's. You know, or I think they said that Charlie wrote something that I'd written. You know, it's just hard to sort of sometimes assert yourself. I think as a woman, if you do that too much, you're sort of seen as shrill or overbearing. But Amy has just been, I mean, she's someone that is so well respected around the industry, and I think has really been a barrier breaker that I look up to. And, you know, I'm really proud to work for her, Woman-owned company now. We're a majority female company, and that's to me really exciting too.
Yeah, well, I'm excited about it as well. And I do think hats off to both Charlie Cook and even Stu Rothenberg, who passed the reins of his outlet to Nathan Gonzalez a few years ago, for both having succession plans with very smart, very able people as they, as the founders, take on more of an emeritus role. You're involved at the race ratings at Cook, especially for, again, for Senate, governor's campaigns as well. Campaigns can sometimes spend a lot of time and effort trying to convince you, your colleagues, to shift a race rating in their direction. What should campaigns know about how you, how the Cook Report approaches those decisions that might make the conversations that are happening inside campaigns a little more productive?
I think when people look at our ratings, you know, if you're not involved in these things, you only sort of see the public numbers necessarily in polling. And we are privy to a lot of private data that they're showing us off the record to make our decisions. And, you know, we're talking frankly about the data. And so, you know, we want to have conversations like that. It's not all each side has to hate one another just because you're a Republican or a Democrat. And I think that sort of gets lost in the Twitterverse that, you know, these consultants that I talk to, they respect one another. I know you've had Republicans on your podcast, obviously, that I know that you admire, that are very smart people. And so I think, you know, that's sort of what, and I think back to even, you know, covering when I was at NPR and covering some of these candidates. And for instance, I covered around New Hampshire, a lot of the Ted Cruz a lot. And I remember talking with one of my colleagues that was covering Trump and just how hard it was to get answers from their campaign and different things. And, you know, Cruz's campaign would, you know, they certainly bash the media. Everybody does in different things too. But when I needed things, they told us. And, you know, all we want to do is be treated as professionals. And I think that was sort of the norm in many instances, sort of pre-2016. And it's unfortunate that sometimes we've sort of gotten to where we are. But, you know, our ratings taken, I think, you know, we look at fundraising, we look at candidate quality. We're talking with a lot of people there on the ground too, not just within the campaigns, but other people that are observing things and different things. So, you know, there's no exact science to it. There's no, you know, you have to meet this metric or something. I think, you know, there's sometimes just a gut feeling you get to that you kind of got to go with your gut. But, you know, we're always sort of reevaluating and looking at what did we miss last time, looking at the polls sort of with a different eye and different things. But the hardest ratings right now, I think that we have out of the ones right now, because it's so early. When I just sort of make my initial 2022 ratings, you base it a lot on history. But I mean, these are going to change. They have to change. Things are going to happen that we don't expect. It's a weighty thing because these ratings matter a lot. And, you know, the campaigns, sometimes when I move to race, I always tell the campaigns in advance, I don't like to sort of give them, you know, a shock or anything. I try to be honest to both sides.
You mentioned sometimes you go with your gut instinct, but what is a race over the years you felt like you had a really clear read on, you personally? And again, maybe that was reflected in the rating, you know, maybe not, but what's a race you felt like you had a really clear read on that maybe ran against the conventional wisdom, but that ultimately you feel like you were proven right on?
Georgia last cycle. We moved the Purdue race, I think it was in July, to toss up. And I got a ton of pushback over that. And I think it was just increasingly, though, that we saw in polling where Purdue had been sort of under 50. You know, I was talking with Republicans that were just incredibly worried about that January scenario. They were seeing, I think, Democratic strength growing there. That was happening in the other race as well. You know, we sort of already moved that race to toss up because of just the, you know, you had the all-party primary there. Honestly, I was hearing more concern among Republicans saying, you know, you need to be looking at these races concurrently because the things that are happening in one race is affecting the other race. And we think that they're sort of going to move together. You know, that was a big move to make. We were the first ones to sort of do that. And like I said, I got a lot of pushback. We were proven right, right in that instance. And, you know, I like to think that we were pretty early in sort of seeing some of those signs and what was developing in Georgia last cycle.
Jessica, I certainly can't talk with you, and it's early in the cycle, of course. I mean, just for context, you and I are talking in early August 2021. But how are you thinking about the 2022 cycle at this point?
It matters which third of the Senate is up. And right now, Democrats are a little less exposed than Republicans are. Republicans have 20 Senate seats versus just 14 for Democrats. And also two of those seats that Republicans are defending are ones that Biden won in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is an open seat, though. Wisconsin may be an open seat. You know, there's open seats that they didn't think they'd have to worry about when Rob Portman retired. I remember when we were actually on a Zoom staff meeting and I wasn't probably watching my Twitter as much that it came across and Amy looked up and she was like, oh, Jessica, Rob Portman retired. And I was like, oh, crap. No one expected that one. Republican recruitment is going to matter so much. And that's what we're looking at. I think it really is. The impetus is on Republicans to recruit strong challengers in places where they should theoretically have a shot, in Arizona and Georgia. But you also have the Trumpian influences that are still there. And you're seeing that a lot right now. For instance, stories that are coming out about Herschel Walker right now that are not coming from Democrats. That's Republican oppo, I can assure you, because they are very worried about the type of candidate that he would be. And that Trump sort of doesn't think, I think we saw him think through things, or at least he had advisors around him when he was in the White House that would influence some of his picks. But now when he's more detached, sort of more free, he's thinking about what would benefit him best, not what would benefit the party writ large. And we saw that, of course, through a lot of his presidency, but also in Arizona, too, who emerges from there, the fact that they have essentially assailed that Trump has just gone after so much Doug Ducey that would be the strongest candidate there that clearly had a lot of crossover appeal in the 2018 election at the same time that Kyrsten Sinema was there. So, you know, he's attacking their best candidates and ones that can win in states that are trending. There are certainly purple states now and ones that are trending toward Democrats. It reminds me a lot of what's happened here in Virginia over the past 12 years, that I think if the party doesn't look at the changing demographics of the state, they're going to be put into the wilderness. And they still have chances. I'm not ruling them out by any means. But right now, I think those are two of the ones that they really have to worry about. And when I talk to a lot of Republicans, they do worry about the quality of candidates that they make it out of there. But of course, we look at history and first-term, midterm elections for a president, often rocky. It more manifests itself in the House, especially you're going to have a redistricting cycle this year. More favor Republicans in that regard with who can redraw the lines. But the Senate, that's not going to happen. So we see less movement in the Senate and first-term midterms, but usually the party out of power does gain a few seats. So we'll see. But I mean, here you have every single seat that matters, because Republicans, if they want to add, they can't afford to lose a Pennsylvania or a Wisconsin because they're going to have to add somewhere else. You know, and I'm not ready by any means to sort of put who's favored or not, but I don't think that this is a hands down simply because Republicans in the Senate are the party out of power that they're going to win overall. I will say for Democrats, it matters if they need to add seats, because the 2024 cycle is going to be brutal for them. These are all of the people that won in 2018. You're going to have Joe Manchin. You're going to have Sherrod Brown. You're going to have John Tester that sit in red, very red states right now. So that could be a really hard cycle for Democrats. They're far more exposed. While the past two cycles have benefited Democrats a little bit more based on the numbers and who was up, 2024 is going to be very hard for Democrats too.
And is there one race, this cycle, one Senate race, that if you think you knew the result of that one specific race, then that probably tells us the basics of what we need to know about how this cycle turned out?
I think it might be North Carolina. It's such a close state, and it's one that Republicans have narrowly won. There was the Cal Cunningham sex scandal that came a few weeks before the election, but Trump still won the state. Even the governor's race was, I think, closer. Of course, Roy Cooper still won, but they lost the lieutenant governor's race, and there were closer races than expected. We've seen a lot of registration numbers move, though, in North Carolina since the election and since, you know, the insurrection day. Is this really Republicans leaving the party? Are there more gettable voters? Are you going to have the Trumpian candidate that kind of emerges from the primary and Ted Budd, who has his endorsement, is the more establishment type candidate, former Governor McCrory, is he going to win the primary? And then even in the Democratic primary, you have Jeff Jackson, who unfortunately for him is very similar to Cal Cunningham. Not in any, you know, bad way, but like he's a centrist military veteran, state legislator, who speaks with a Southern accent and has really good hair. Versus we are seeing Democrats actively recruit more Black candidates and more Black women. The fact that you have there Sherry Beasley, former Chief Justice, running. And I think, you know, it's important to note that right now the Senate has no Black women after Kamala Harris became vice president. So, you know, you're seeing Black women run there. You're seeing Val Demings run. There's also the idea, and I think this could be tested if she gets the nomination too, is that going to drive out more Black voters too?
Well, let's talk a bit about the Almanac of American Politics. I mean, you talked about some of your early days interning on that and being involved in one from the previous decade, 2006, 2008, as you were just getting your foot in the door. The Almanac of American Politics, a monumental work every 2 years, and many, many of us, those of us who work in politics, can attribute a lot of our interest and how we think about politics directly to the Almanac. That's certainly my story. I won't belabor it here, but I even talked about this recently in a short profile I did with Roll Call. But you've been involved with several editions, Jessica, of the Almanac of American Politics. And in this new 2022 version, you're a senior author, the first woman to be a senior author of the Almanac of American Politics in its 50-year history. What is your understanding of the origin story of how the Almanac came to be? Who was involved? How did that happen?
If you get the 2022 edition, which is on sale now, you can go to almanacofamericanpolitics.com. Michael Barone, who was, of course, the founder, has a special essay in it that sort of details the origins of the Almanac. It started Vietnam era, war protests and different things. He was at Harvard with Grant Ujafusa, who was the other contributor. And they started talking about, you know, wanting to have profiles of some of these members of Congress for activists there at the school, but, you know, to be able to contact, look at their records, to look at their voting history and different things. So this was protesting military action in Cambodia. And you know, they started talking. And if you've ever met Michael Barone, he just has sort of a fascinating memory. And he knows all of these unique facts about just all of America. And I think he sort of details that in the essay, sort of about how things that he read and sort of got him interested in political geography. Grant Ujafusa was actually from Wyoming. And he's like, nobody really knows anything about where I'm from and all of these specific places. I think it goes back to, again, who these people are and how they got there, I think matters a lot for how they are legislators and how they approach things. And so they sort of came upon this idea of trying to profile all of them and all of the districts, bought a electric typewriter for $140 to sort of start this, and, you know, carbon copied paper. And the most fascinating sort of thing to me was the way that they would get information, because this is, you know, the early 70s, you can't log online and find any newspaper. But there was, I guess, a newsstand there in Boston that had a lot of out-of-town major papers. So they'd go, you know, once a week and get these newspapers and sort of scour them for interesting things and highlight them and mark them and save them. And so that's a big way that they got a lot of information. They used, you know, different atlases, and it was this newsstand in Harvard Square that they would, you know, get, they went every month, excuse me, from the major newspapers from all 50 states. So it was a much different way that they had to approach things. And, you know, I think they thought, Michael also talks about, really thought they would sort of maybe be a one-off thing. But I think junkies and people got so interested in it. And, you know, sort of, you know, it moved through. National Journal obviously came to own it and produce it. Columbia Books is now the publisher. I mean, there were a few years ago, which after sort of National Journal's contract expired, there was a question of whether even it would continue to exist. And Rich Cohen, who is the chief author and was one of the authors that I worked with, he was, of course, National Journal's longtime congressional correspondent, sort of helped rescue it in a way. And so I think we owe a lot of gratitude to him for, you know, still that it's being published and that we've made it to the 50th edition. What I love is that you have a volume every 2 years that can capture where America was then. You can go back, you can look at what these members did. You can look at the essays at the beginning to sort of analyze the broader trends in American politics. I think it's just so important. Probably one of my favorite parts of the Almanac, and this is, again, I think a lot of Michael in the way that, you know, he visited some of these districts. He, you know, was making calls to people. The detail that is in some of these profiles is just, I mean, it's poetic, I think. I really think in some of the prose that is written about things that you can sort of imagine the evolution of places and people, generations and trends and different things. When Charlie Mattesian left to go to Politico, he asked me to come back. They sort of wanted someone who had worked on the Almanac before to have a cohesion. So they asked me to come back and be one of the, at that time, we usually had three researchers that were doing all of the research. So I was research director. I was the lead researcher. You know, we weren't going to the corner bookstore to get newspapers and different things. You know, we're looking through LexisNexis. We're looking through sites. We're looking through people's web pages. And this was a time when we printed everything out. We would highlight things. We would make notes. We had these huge folders and file folders that we would take to Rich, who was writing, and to Michael. So, you know, that was part of our job too. I lugged around, you know, boxes of research. the last cycle that, like I said, Rich at this point had sort of taken it over. He asked me to come and be a contributing author on the last edition. The research has changed and evolved once again. Everything that we get is all digital. I think one of the challenges that we had this year in writing, at least for me, is we tried to get a lot of the research done, you know, on the non-competitive races or non-competitive members or ones, senators that aren't up for re-election before the election. So you get a head start so that we can start writing as soon as the election is over. Because it really is just a few months that we have to try to turn this around, get it to the printer, get it out. While a lot of the research that I got, though, at least for, you know, some of the members of Congress, I did a lot of the senators, most of the senators, what happened on January 6th and how they reacted to the election and whether they believed it was fraudulent. I mean, that was a huge chunk that I had to go back and find because it was so influential. I mean, I did Bill Cassidy's profile, and obviously that's going to be the focus of a lot of what he did and sort of how he got to that decision to sort of buck his party. The same way I did Richard Burr. You know, that was a lot of what that I felt was really important in our time to make sure that is there for history to see how some of these members reacted to, you know, what I think is, when we look back on congressional history, I think is going to be a really pivotal moment.
Is there a factoid that you've learned in the almanac process about a senator that caught your eye, is really interesting, something you didn't know that jumped out at you?
Two things. And these were both from a long time ago when I was researching it. Again, I'm from Tennessee. I have never known Lamar Alexander to not be in politics. He was governor when I was born. Probably one of the most fun days I had on the trail was when he was campaigning in 2014. You remember he had a primary challenge and he won, but I remember probably talking with some people close to him. He actually lost his home county in Blount County, and I think that really hurt him. You know, this is sort of the Tea Party resurgence and different things, but I got to ride along on the bus with him one day and do a profile of that. And, you know, Lamar's legendary. My dad had the black and red and black plaid shirt, and he referred to it as his Lamar shirt. I know people that when he walked across the state, he stayed at their house. Sad right now in a way to think about a Senate where Lamar Alexander isn't there. But when I was researching his profile, so this was for the 2010 edition, they just discovered this bug in the Smoky Mountains, actually. And it sort of looked like for a red and black plaid. And they named it after him. It's called the Cosabrella Lamar Alexandri. He has a bug named after him. I think that's just really cool. And then I remember another profile I was working on was John Lewis. There was a man that had, when he was protesting, I think it was when he was in Greensboro, perhaps, but had come back and apologized to him, you know, for what he did. And that's just something, you know, including that was just really moving when you see that. And it's, I think, again, especially being raised in the South and having some of that undercurrent racial discord, certainly that's always there. And I think as a white person, you aren't really sure how to approach it sometimes. But that story, you know, it's a feel good story, but certainly doesn't overshadow a lot of the bad things that happened. But I just, that was a story that I enjoyed including.
No, a lot of us don't buy as many hard copy books as we used to, but I do think there's something different about having a real hard copy of the almanac at your fingertips. And in addition, I think it's a fun goal for a real political junkie to track down the previous version of the almanacs going back to the 70s and the 80s. And if you have a copy of the 74 almanac, you can see Joe Biden's first entry after winning his Senate race in 72. If you have the 76 almanac, you can read about Bill Clinton's failed congressional race in Arkansas. If you have the 80 almanac, you can read about George W. Bush's failed congressional race in Texas, and the list goes on. You know, I'm going to be tracking down a hard copy to make sure my collection stays up to date. Jessica, do you have a recommendation for something? I mean, non-political, a movie, a TV show, a recipe, a product, you know, something that you've been enjoying recently that you'd suggest people give a try?
I'm also really interested in the intersection between politics and religion. And again, I think that goes to my upbringing. And I wrote a lot of things, especially in 2016, looking at white evangelicals and Donald Trump. And, you know, like a lot of people, I think, given my upbringing and where, you know, again, Bill Clinton was the worst person imaginable, the Lewinsky scandal and all of that. And then to see a lot of people sort of get behind him, even when I can remember just being floored at, you know, when he was asked, I think it kind of got brushed over at an Iowa event, because this was the same event where he said that John McCain was not a war hero. But where he said that he never asked God for forgiveness, which if you're an evangelical, you know that confessing your sins and asking Jesus for salvation is the crux of your faith. So things like that shocked me that people didn't pick up on it more, or different things. I remember I was actually at Liberty University when he made the infamous 2 Corinthians mistake and different things, and cursed several times through it. Just very jarring things. One book that I've really enjoyed, it's by a professor at Calvin University, Kristen Cobes Dume, called Jesus and John Wayne. It sort of looks at the effect of masculinity in politics and how I think Trump sort of personified that, but going through a lot of history. So it is sort of political still, but you know, it's made a lot of waves in sort of the evangelical circles and ex-evangelical circles and different things. So that's one I've really enjoyed sort of reading for fun. Side thing I'm always really interested in is the intersection between religion and politics too.
Jessica, this has been a lot of fun. Folks should follow Jessica on Twitter. Check out the Cook Report with Amy Walter. Get their hands on the 2022 Almanac, of which Jessica is a senior author. And Jessica, thanks so much for your time today.
We are also having on August 18th a panel discussion with all of the authors talking about the new book that you can attend. If you attend, you can use the discount code EVENT22 for 25% off of your almanac.
People should take advantage of that. I can almost guarantee that I will be lurking there as well. And Jessica, this was great. Thanks for making some time for me.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Zach. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to the Pro Politics Podcast. Please subscribe so you can access each episode first thing every Tuesday morning. And if you're so inclined, leave a rating and a short review on your podcast app to help more people find this podcast. And follow us on Twitter and Facebook for updates on upcoming guests. Thanks for listening.